Postmaster General Louis DeJoy's D.C. home this weekend. Some had signs calling him the Postmaster Saboteur. There are growing concerns the post office will not be able to handle the mass move toward voting by mail this November. DeJoy has now agreed to testify next Monday before the House Oversight Committee. Late last week, the Postal Service told officials in almost every state that it could not guarantee that all ballots would arrive in time to be counted. Well, over the weekend, Twitter was flooded with pictures of blue mailboxes being hauled away on truck beds. Speaker Nancy Pelosi has now called lawmakers back to Washington this week for hearings on this growing crisis. Jacob Bogage is business reporter for The Washington Post, and he joins us now. Hi.
There. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, it seems like people are getting pretty upset about all this. How widespread are these protests?
Yeah, there were protests outside his home or his apartment building, I should say, in Washington, D.C. over the weekend. Another outside his home in Greensboro, North Carolina. I can only gauge this from emails from readers and folks on social media, but there's a lot of anger about this. There's so many reasons beyond the November election why a National Postal Service is important. It's folks getting their medications that are mailed and paychecks and bills. There's a lot of reasons why we need a functioning postal service.
Right. Well, so what about concerns about the election, though? There were reports that sorting machines have been removed, that, as I mentioned, these mailboxes are being removed, postal hours have been cut. All of that could affect the election. The Postal Service seems to think that it's going to be difficult. I mean, they did issue this warning to the states. It might be difficult to process all these mail-in ballots.
Yeah, there's a lot of things there. So let's kind of take it apart. In terms of the volume of mail-in ballots, we're really looking at, especially if they're spread out over time, which we anticipate they will be, a drop in the bucket of Postal Service volumes. Yeah, it could rise a little bit, but it shouldn't be anything that postal workers aren't equipped to deal with. In terms of the sorting machines, we've reported that the Postal Service is taking 671 bulk high-speed mail sorting machines offline between now and the end of the month. That'd be about 10% of the Postal Service's inventory of machines. And that sounds like a big number, but the Postal Service has had excess capacity for a long time. And these machine removals were in place before the Postal Service. I think the two policy changes, and these were instituted directly by the new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, that are most concerning are, one, this crackdown on overtime hours, and two, this prohibition on making extra trips to deliver mail on time. So if you had, you know, in the past, mail that was, you had a backlog mail, or if you had, you know, I was a letter carrier, I went out to start my route at 9 o'clock in the morning, and some mail came in after I left at 9:15, we'd send somebody else out to deliver that mail. We're not doing that anymore. And so The issue is, if these cost-cutting measures create backlogs, what's going to get caught up in these backlogs? And potentially, could that be ballots? And that's the main concern.
Right. So I guess the other concern is why this is being done now, and Democrats are suspicious that this is being done to help Trump win re-election, noting that DeJoy is a big contributor to Donald Trump, or was to his last campaign. And so how much of this is timed to coincide with the election versus what was going to happen anyway to address the cost problems?
The Postal Service says a lot of this was supposed to be done anyway. In terms of the mailbox removals, well, let's start with the sorting machine removals. I mean, those have predated the Postmaster General, though he could have said, hey, maybe we should keep these online until the election. It might be important to have them. He didn't say that. The mailbox removals, the Postal Service told me that this is routine, that we remove mailboxes from low volume areas. But they also said it's on a case-by-case basis, and which made it seem like there's no threshold at which they would consider an area to be low volume and worthy of that mailbox getting removed. The president didn't help that cause the other week when he said he would withhold funding for the Postal Service in the goal that it would hobble the Postal Service from conducting vote by mail, which he's opposed to. So it's hard to line up all the cards to definitively say that this is being done to impact the election, because a lot of the stuff has been, you know, has predated the Postal Service, which frankly does need to cut costs. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean it won't make facilitating the election more difficult.
Well, speaking of money, the Democrats want to give the Postal Service a lot more money, and President Trump has made conflicting statements over whether he'd accept that or not. So where are they now with earmarking more funds for the Postal Service right now?
We're edging toward some sort of compromise deal, but that could change any minute. The White House has started to soften, it seems, a little bit on providing some more funding for the Postal Service. Democrats in the House want $25 billion. The White House has come back is $10 billion. So maybe we'll get somewhere in that range. It's likely at this point, it seems like it would be broken out into a separate bill rather than part of another round of coronavirus spending. But you have to remember that the Senate is on recess. They're not going to be back until September. So we got some time to go here.
So anything that the House does coming back early from recess wouldn't go into effect?
No, I mean, it's got to get through the Senate. I mean, the House is interested in taking up a bill that sponsored by Oversight Chair Carolyn Maloney of New York that would invalidate these policy changes that the Postmaster General was making and prohibit any other sort of operational changes between now and the end of the pandemic. My understanding is that the Senate doesn't have an appetite to take that bill up, but I think it would consider funding if it got the go-ahead from the White House.
Jacob Bogage is business reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about the legal implications surrounding the Postal Service. Earlier today, a few people in New York, including some candidates for office there, filed a federal suit in Manhattan. Separately, attorneys general in several other states are looking into ways to sue the federal government and block it from reducing mail service. It's Monday, so that means Jessica Levinson is here, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal eagle. Hello.
Hello. Happy Monday.
Well, happy Monday to you, too. So first, tell us about this suit in Manhattan. It happened not so long ago. What does it say?
Well, what we know right now is that it says, court, you have to force adequate funding of the Postal Service. And if you don't, there's going to be a federal legal issue. And that's about as specific as we have gotten with respect to these cases. The two statutes that are being looked at most closely with respect to potential federal violations that the USPS issues would bring up. One deals with somebody who would willfully and knowingly obstruct the passage of mail. So this was usually used as a shield by the Postal Service, but in this case, it could be used as a sword against actions by the Postal Service. There's another statute that on the federal level we're looking at that deals with people who use their official position to interfere with the nomination or election of president or vice president. It's a long way of saying we're in uncharted waters here.
Well, could that include President Trump himself after he made comments last week, basically admitting the reason why he wanted to withhold funds was to affect the vote by mail? Is that possibly illegal with what he said?
It's really remarkable that you have the president of the United States saying what we usually say quietly. He's saying very loudly. You know, usually we say, oh, there's a reason, it's cost cutting, we're trying to prevent fraud. But in this case, you have the president of the United States saying, I just want to reduce vote by mail, because clearly he thinks that would help him win the election. Now, we have seen, you know, you asked me about the legal issues. We have seen courts be reticent to basically take President Trump too seriously, let's say, when it comes to comments that he makes either on Twitter or over on cable news shows. So it's not clear that that would be enough to win a lawsuit.
Okay, so I guess the cost-cutting measures DeJoy has implemented, they've been proposed before. We just talked about that in the last segment by the agency's own watchdog. So that would be complicating, right, for any potential lawsuit?
Absolutely. That would be complicating. So the fact that you would, let's say, typically remove some mailboxes, that would complicate these lawsuits. The fact that it wasn't just right before the election that you say the USPS has to save some money, that would be complicating. But as your first guest talked about, you also have to acknowledge that even though maybe these cuts were discussed beforehand, even though maybe some of this would be routine, we're not in a routine situation. We're in a world where states are going to have to ramp up vote by mail in a speed and scale that we've really never seen before. And it's rational to say that the Postal Service is legally obligated to acknowledge that, to acknowledge that maybe funding cuts that would have worked when we could go to the polls simply would interfere with your right to vote in this particular situation.
Well, given what we've just heard, the Senate not coming back till September, the sort of the slow wheels of the legislative process as they go through in Washington, plus the idea of these lawsuits and getting all these perhaps state attorneys general to sign on, how feasible is it that something could be done in enough time before November?
Yeah, this is the reason why, if listeners could see me, I'm semi in fetal position right now, because this is not quick. I mean, you and I started talking about this, I think, in March and April, saying states have to scale up. The Postal Service has to be ready. So at this point, honestly, what you're trying to do is triage and to make sure that even if there's bleeding, basically the patient doesn't bleed out, that at least there is enough funding. And practically speaking, what you have to do is one of the things that the Democrats in Congress are talking about, which is an educational program, telling the voters, even if you cannot, even if you don't get your ballot in time to mail it back, let's say, here are the rules about postmarks. So maybe you have more time than you think, or here are places where you can drop off your ballot and still be distanced, or here are more early in-person voting places. It's going to be a mix of legal and practical solutions at this point.
Okay. I want to briefly turn to another story in the news. On Friday, the federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down California's ban on high-capacity gun magazines. And this was actually a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit, the vote 2-1 with the Trump appointee writing the opinion. And what did it say?
Yeah, so what the court said here is that we're overturning, as you said, California's ban on large capacity ammunition magazines because it violates the Second Amendment. And specifically, the court spent a lot of time, it was a 66-page decision, talking about the right to self-defense. And what the court said is that this criminalizes half of all magazines in the country. Basically, it sweeps too broadly. What was interesting here is you have, as you said, a 2-1 decision. The two judges who were in the majority were both appointed by Republicans. But the decision does acknowledge that there's been a lot of gun violence, acknowledges the background with which they've made this decision, and basically suggests some other legislation that might pass the Second Amendment, but just says this sweeps too broadly.
And California Attorney General Javier Becerra, will he appeal to the Supreme Court?
So first you might ask for the whole Ninth Circuit to hear this case. And then you could appeal to the Supreme Court. It looks like, much to the Supreme Court's chagrin, that there may actually be a circuit split soon. At that point, it will be hard for the Supreme Court to avoid taking this question, even though we've seen that the court has tried to avoid a big gun rights decision, at least in the short term.
Jessica Levinson teaches law at Loyola Law School, and she is our regular legal here on Press Play. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Coming up, the nation's second largest school district, that's Los Angeles, unveils an ambitious COVID testing plan. We'll have the details next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. LAUSD has announced the country's most ambitious coronavirus testing program and contact tracing plan for public school students, staff, and families. It would include 700,000 students, according to Superintendent Austin Buettner. As of right now, plans for distance learning are still in place for the fall, but according to Buettner, this effort will help prepare for the eventual return to in-person classes. But because this is a pilot program, there are a lot of issues to prepare for.
The labs may have issues. Test results might be late. Students or staff might be absent on the day of testing at a school, or contact tracing efforts might not reach every family. But if it works, it can be a model for other school districts and communities across the country.
Joining me to discuss this is Howard Bloom, education reporter for the LA Times. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, the details are a little sketchy, but what do we know so far? When would they roll out this testing plan?
Well, they're saying that they are rolling it out today, sort of, but it's not clear what rollout means because they are not testing anybody that I know of today, and it's not clear when that first test will actually take place. That's a question we have into the school district. There are a lot of unknowns about this. And we do know that they're going to roll this out gradually, which makes sense, really. And also, you know, it should be stipulated that this doesn't mean that the schools are reopening. This is what's going to happen in the main once schools reopen, and we don't know when that's going to be. But, of course, if you want this plan in place by the time schools reopen, you have to get working on it now and start building it up.
And how is it going to work? He announced that he has some partnerships with universities and with companies. Can you describe what that means?
Well, yeah, a testing program is multi-level. And if you've been watching or listening to Governor Newsom's briefings every day, you know how complicated this whole testing architecture is. So you have to have tests. You have to have labs that will evaluate the tests and send them back. And statewide, you know, we have a big problem with having enough tests and getting the results back quickly. So they've tried to deal with the architecture of that. They have a couple of labs lined up to provide tests and to also process the tests, because a test is a snapshot in time. And if you don't get results back quickly from a test, it actually has limited value. So that's one thing. And then you also have the contact tracing part of this. And the district is going to try to have its own people do both the testing and the contact tracing. The contact tracing will be carried out in part by bus drivers, as it turns out, because they are not driving buses of school children now. And now I guess they'll have to be trained to become contact tracers. So there are a lot of people who are taking on new roles. Yeah, this is a major public health exercise that the district is not familiar with, but you know, learning as we go, as we say.
Yeah, and one of those learners is also this new company, Summer Bio, which is going to process the spit and nasal tests, or some of them. And he said LAUSD would be Summer Bio's first customer. Does that give you
right,
pause?
It does. And there's actually one major element of this that I left out. There are three universities involved in this partnership: Johns Hopkins, Stanford, and UCLA. And part of what the universities are going to try to figure out is they're going to try to look at the epidemiological models and see how much testing to do, how often, and who to test. I mean, obviously, if you get a positive test result, you're going to test everybody associated with that, and you're going to retest as well. But if you're trying to get a sense of what's safe and what's not safe, what is your baseline testing? And they're going to feed a lot of information to this model. There's an app that's going to be provided by Microsoft that is part of this. So everybody's supposed to report their daily symptoms into the app, which is going to gather data across the district. Now, as you've reported on your show, you've cover the idea of asymptomatic transmission, right? So having a fever does not necessarily tell you everything, but they're going to try to crunch all these numbers and tell the district where, when, and how much to test. And yes, this could not work exactly right, but, you know, it's not like anybody else has a better plan at the moment. And Austin Buettner actually initially was asking the county and the state to take on this role of testing, saying it was crucial to getting the schools open. And the county said, well, we can't do it. We don't have the resources. So they're saying, well, all right, let's see if we can do it ourselves.
By resources, do they mean money?
Yes, that's ultimately what resources mean. I mean, it also, staffing is part of it. I mean, if you think about what's happening statewide, the state has had money to do certain things, but there hasn't been capacity. They've had to train the contact tracers. So that's been challenged to get enough of those. There aren't enough contact tracers nationwide. If there was a problem with reagents that you needed to get the test results to make sense, right? And the testing kits were a problem. So money is a major issue, but it's not actually the only issue. There are supply chain and staffing issues as well.
And where is LAUSD going to get the money for this? Because he said, Buettner said today, it would cost about $300 per student. So that's $210 million.
Right. Well, he said, he also said it would be about $150 million. So he was kind of talking about the K-12 linking to that. But they're estimating $150 million at the moment. So that's still a lot of money. And they've received at least three times that amount, well over that, actually, in state and federal aid. Now, they would argue that they still need more money, but technically they have enough money to do this. It's just a question of, do they have enough money to do all the things they need to do? So they can pick two or three or four or 20 things they need to do, and they have enough money. Whether they can do all 50 that they may want to do is another question. I mean, they've also replaced all the filters in the air conditioning systems, which is actually a great idea, and put in a higher grade filter, and that's probably cost some money too. So far, they have money. But at some point, it is a fair question, do they have enough? And, you know, their position is that they need and deserve more.
Howard Bloom covers education for the LA Times. Thank you.
Sure.
Coming up, the Democratic National Convention begins tonight, but why have political conventions at all? A former delegate speaks.
The truth is, I didn't do anything. Of course, the president and vice presidential candidates had already been selected. The party platform had already been adopted. I was never even given a copy of the party platform or asked to vote on it.
We'll get the pro side, too. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, tonight, the Democratic National Convention kicks off. And just like everything else this year, it's going to look a little different. No balloon drops, no in-person roll call, no delegates chanting on the floor, enthusiastically waving placards bearing their state's name. Instead, those delegates will be scattered around the country with primetime speakers joining remotely. All raising the question, should we even have party conventions? We're going to talk about that now with Dave Cheslevich. He's the former mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, and he twice served as a delegate to the DNC. Welcome.
Thank you, Mela.
Also joining us, Emily Baer. She's a political scientist at the University of New Hampshire, and she studies political parties and institutions there. Welcome to you, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And let's begin with you. You are in favor of conventions. Why?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's kind of easy to forget because conventions don't play that formal nominating role anymore, right? We know who the Democratic and Republican nominee is going to be weeks, if not months, before the actual convention. But I think they play an incredibly important role helping to build party unity and educate the American public. I mean, it's easy to forget, but conventions were originally kind of conceived of as a way to bridge geographic and sectional differences between different factions within the party, right? That rare moment where everyone can come together and realize that they have more that unites them than divides them.
So it's an important civics lesson for the American public. It's also a good way to build party unity. Dave, you think conventions are basically a waste of time and should be scrapped?
I don't know if I go that far. I think Emily makes a lot of good points about their value. And if I had a guess, I would say they probably aren't going to go away. I would bet that when we're past the virus, we'll probably have in-person conventions again in 2024. But I was a delegate to a couple of conventions, the one in Boston in 2004 and 2008, where we nominated Barack Obama. And I have to say, I had a great time. I went to a lot of parties and got to meet a lot of people, and it was exciting to be there. But the truth is, I didn't do anything. I was a full delegate, and yet I was never asked to vote on anything. Of course, the president and vice presidential candidates had already been selected. The party platform had already been adopted. I was never even given a copy of the party platform or asked to vote on it. And so I didn't really do anything. I was essentially there, and I understood why I was there, to be backdrop for the television coverage of the primetime speeches. That was my purpose in being there. And these things are very expensive. So the convention in Milwaukee, had it actually happened in person, would have cost about $70 million. And, you know, that money is almost all coming from large corporations and major donors and lobbyists who are paying for access to powerful politicians.
Well, Emily, what about that point about this being a potential corrupting institution in the way that it is funded? I mean, Dave makes the point that you've got lobbyists buying access, and when they pay money, they probably expect a favor in return. And so what about that aspect of it?
No, I think Dave is absolutely right. If you attend a convention, you will see every major possible interest group, down from kind of the grassroots groups that do not have a lot of moneyed resources up to kind of the most moneyed groups, all converge on the convention city. They host events that are quite expensive to attend, and they are paying for access. That is what they want. At the same time, symbolically, these are groups who are part of those parties' coalitions. And I don't think we should forget the fact that there are average kind of party activists, average citizens who converge on the convention city too. And this is a really, again, a rare opportunity for the party to reach out to them.
But pre-COVID, it's hard to get into the convention as just a regular citizen, right? I mean, you have to have some kind of credential to get in. Sure, you can protest on the outside, but you can protest on the outside of anything at any time. Why is it, I guess, more democratic in the sense that you're talking about for this to take place at the conventions?
Yeah, so I would actually argue that we need more conventions, more off-year conventions, that there's more opportunities to do this without so much kind of media attention and so much emphasis on kind of those moneyed interests. But there actually aren't that many opportunities for so many people to converge in one place who have kind of a stake in the party's future, who, you know, can get excited about all of the work that remains to be done for the general election. You know, just because you're not in the hall, it is hard to get a credential to go inside the hall, so I'm not discounting that. But there are lots of other ways, again, that average citizen, that average party activist, to participate in a convention, even if they never get a credential to go inside the hall.
So, Dave, over the weekend, Michigan Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, one of the members of the squad, voted no on the Democratic Party platform. She says it was because it does not include a plan for single-payer health care. But as you said, you didn't even vote on the platform. Does adopting a party platform even matter?
Doesn't seem to. I can't remember a time when the party platform played any kind of meaningful role in who actually got elected president. Sometimes, you know, there's a dust up over it. These things are usually adopted well before the convention. And so usually by the time delegates actually show up, whatever disagreements there were have been smoothed over. And as I say, I never actually voted on the platform in the conventions I attended. So I don't, and then after the convention, even if there has been some controversy over it, it tends to get forgotten by November. So I just don't think those platforms are particularly meaningful in terms of the actual outcome of the election.
And Emily, what do you think? There was, of course, the fight over superdelegates, which did end up being changed at the last convention 4 years ago.
Yes. So absolutely, the conventions are an opportunity for the party to consider potential reforms to their nominating process. And I would expect to see potentially future discussions around this, if not this year at the or this week, I should say, at the convention, certainly in the coming years. But I'll just tag on to the point about platforms. Yes, they're very much just a symbol of the party's policy positions, but they do help to normalize policy positions within a party that maybe haven't received kind of universal universal support. I will say, kind of anecdotally, in the 1960s, members of Congress of both parties were able to point to the Democratic and Republican Party platforms as a way to pressure their colleagues to vote on behalf of civil rights legislation. I mean, it was something that it had been normalized within the party platform, and then legislation was seen through that actually upheld those platform planks. So on rare occasions, they do matter.
But you can adopt a party platform without having a full-blown convention.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, the actual drafting of the platform would happen, you know, weeks, months before the actual convention. But I don't know, if you didn't have that deadline of the convention, I don't know that the parties would actually go to the effort of bringing in voices from the local and state and national level together. I think it's something that would probably be driven too much at the national level.
Well, speaking of voices, conventions are often an opportunity to hear from members of the party who don't have a national voice or a national platform yet. And that was the case for a man named Barack Obama in 2004 when he addressed the DNC in Boston. And let's hear a clip from that.
It's the hope of slaves sitting around a fire singing freedom songs. The hope of immigrants setting out for distant shores. The hope of a young naval lieutenant bravely patrolling the Mekong Delta. The hope of a mill worker's son who dares to defy the odds. The hope of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him too.
So that just vaulted him to national prominence. Dave, you were there in the audience. What was that like?
It was an amazing moment. I mean, both my wife and I were there in Boston. We had never heard of Barack Obama before then. And 4 years later, I was supporting him for president of the United States. And I think that was the last time that anything unexpected and really meaningful happened during a convention. And that was 2004. No one had heard of Barack Obama. He gave an amazing speech, hit it out of the park. And I think without that, he probably wouldn't have been president of the United States 4 years later. But that's the last time I can remember something that significant happening.
Although, Emily, there were other rising stars at past conventions, right? Bill Clinton in 88, Ronald Reagan in 76, and both of those conventions catapulted them to even greater national political relevance. So does that happen perhaps more frequently than Dave is saying?
Yeah, I think because the thing is that this is one of those situations where we don't know until we see that great speech that we're going to have this great introduction to a future party leader. Right. I will say that, you know, setting aside the pandemic, the more that we have this explosion of social media and new ways that future political leaders can, you know, gather their own constituency base and introduce themselves to the public, perhaps the less important that great introductory speech at a convention is. Having said that, you know, again, it's that rare occasion where the establishment of the party is saying this is one of our future leaders, and that matters.
So, Dave, you know, this was supposed to be in Milwaukee, this convention starting tonight. As you mentioned, $70 million was set to be spent on it, and a lot of ancillary funding for the city and for the state of Wisconsin. What does this mean economically, not having it? In real time.
Yeah, it's a huge disappointment for Milwaukee. I grew up there. I still have relatives there. And this was really an opportunity for Milwaukee to introduce itself to the world. A lot of people, you know, if they think about Milwaukee at all, maybe they think Laverne and Shirley or something like that. And this was an opportunity for Milwaukee to showcase all the things it is. And it really is a great town. It's got a beautiful lakefront, a beautiful river walk, a very diverse community, great restaurants, great music. And 50,000 people would have attended this convention, about 2,000 members of the press. And of course, it would have been, you know, beamed internationally. And those folks who showed up, and, you know, hopefully they would have enjoyed themselves, they would have gone back to their communities. And by definition, they're pretty much influential folks back home. If they returned home with a real positive image of the city, who knows what that might have meant in the long run. So, yes, it's a tremendous disappointment.
So even though you are questioning the merit of conventions in general, you're saying not having them would be a loss for at least Milwaukee.
Sure, you bet. I mean, for a place like Milwaukee or Charlotte, yeah, it would have made a big difference. And so, yeah, it is disappointing for those communities.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us today. Dave Cheslevich, former Democratic mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, and Emily Baer, political scientist at the University of New Hampshire. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, they had the beat and the hits, how the Go-Go's made music history. We'll speak with a member of the band and with the director of a new documentary on the Go-Go's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Go-Go's have been record setters since they debuted in the early 1980s. They were the first and only all-woman band who wrote their own songs, played their own instruments, and made it to the top of the Billboard album charts. Well, it's been nearly 40 years since their album Beauty and the Beat came out. Their many hits remain staples of any good 80s playlist. But after releasing their first new song in decades last month, the Go-Go's origin story and their struggles are the subject of a new documentary. It's called The Go-Go's, and director Allison Elwood joins me now. Hi.
Hi.
And we're also joined by Go-Go's guitarist and backup vocalist, Jane Weedland. Hi, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
I am fine, thank you. Well, that song, take us back to when you first performed it, when you first heard it, actually, because one of your bandmates, Charlotte Caffey, she wrote it, and she told you, Allison, that she was actually scared to share it with the rest of the band members because she thought, oh, it would be too poppy. Jane, what was your reaction when you first heard that song?
When I first heard it, my heart started racing, and it was very exciting. And when we started playing it together in the rehearsal room and Gina started playing those pounding drums, it was like, oh my God, this is like a monster. It was just really good.
So you didn't think it was too poppy because you were doing really punk sounding music. Like you were punk musicians.
I feel like we were doing like the Buzzcocks and the Ramones. We were doing what was essentially pop music played at a breakneck speed.
But did you think of it that way at the time?
No, I just thought we were punk at the time. But I mean, Charlotte joined the band just a few months after we started, and things started shifting relatively quickly after that because she and I discovered that we had a real affinity for writing with each other. And also that, she, like me, had a very, very pop background as far as growing up and loving the Beatles and stuff like that. So, I mean, it isn't really a surprise to me that we kind of morphed into sort of a pop rock band and a punk rock band. The other thing I would say is that in the 70s, I don't know that anyone felt like punk was going to be something that we did forever. It was more of like of the moment in the way that glitter rock was. I mean, I love glitter rock. I was a full on glitter rocker, all the clothes, all the music. And then the punk scene came along and I was like, oh, that's what I am now.
So, Allison, when you were doing the research for this, what did you initially know about the Go-Go's?
Well, I was a fan of the music, but I didn't know about their punk roots. So that was really fun for me to learn about and discover that whole thing. Because, you were just talking about We Got the Beat. When they started playing that, they played it really fast. It sounds very punk in the film. You sort of hear the song evolve into more of a pop tune as the film goes on.
Yeah. So this was the scene in L.A., which was really an underground punk scene, but really influential. Can you describe what it was like, Jane?
Well, ground zero for the punk scene in 76 was a club called The Mask. And that was in the really, really horrible basement of a porno theater on Hollywood Boulevard. And at that time, Hollywood was very, very seedy. And you can imagine being in a disgusting basement in the bottom of a porno theater. Like, it doesn't get any seedier than that. But about 50 kids found each other and started this scene, and there was just so much enthusiasm and so much fun and so much debauchery. It was like the greatest time to be an 18-year-old that I could ever have imagined.
And how did you meet Belinda?
She was just part of the scene, and you know, before I met her, I remember seeing her around all the time and super admiring her because she was so beautiful and she always looked so incredible. And she just like had poise and charisma, and I don't know, it was cool when we got to be in a band together and she was the lead singer. Charlotte joined a few months later. She had actually gone to college and studied music and knew music theory. She knew how to read music. She was way beyond us musically. So that was like, that was a big step forward for us. And then Gina joined the following year. She had been in a couple bands. She had been playing drums since she was 15. She was an amazing musician. And then finally, the year after that, Kathy joined, and she had also been playing in bands for a long time. And, you know, she didn't read music, which doesn't matter when you're in a rock band, but she was had a lot of experience.
Well, let's hear a little bit from those early days. Here's a clip from a 1978 show when you were not the Go-Go's we all know about now. I wouldn't even think that that was, I don't know. I wouldn't think that was you at all.
Well, I had been raised in a very strict Catholic Midwestern family. And part of the game there is like the girls are just supposed to be seen and not heard. You're not allowed to be angry or any of that stuff. You're just supposed to be sweet all the time. So that's all well and good. And I, you know, I did end up being a nice, sweet, people-pleasing girl. But I think when that happens to you, like you have to push all, any kind of anger you have to push in, down inside, right? So when the punk scene came around, everyone else was like so pissed off. Like I was like, oh my God, I'm pissed off too. So I got in touch with my angry side and I just started writing all these super angry songs, and it was really, really liberating and really fun to play that kind of music.
Yeah. And Allison, put this in perspective, if you will, like how groundbreaking were these young women? They probably weren't thinking they were being political in a feminist way, but they ended up being pretty significant.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the songs may sound pop, but the lyrics, there's a lot of deep and dark stuff sometimes going on. When you really experience them in the punk days, you really can see that and hear that now in the music, even though it sounds much more pop than what you just played. That actual concert, that was the Elks Lodge concert, Jane. That was the one that got raided by the police.
Yeah, so yeah, that was the other thing, is just sort of the climate of society and the climate of politics and stuff. Punk rockers were really, really hated. I mean, we were like the hippies when the hippies first came around and everyone hated them. And there was this concert, all the popular or even semi-popular LA bands were playing it. And we got through our set, but shortly after there, the LA riot squad showed up like in full SWAT outfits, shields, batons, guns, helmets, for no reason. There was absolutely nothing going on. It was literally just a concert, and they came in and just started bashing people's heads. It was unbelievable. It was crazy. And then after that, it was always called the St. Patrick's Day Massacre. It was shocking. And so, you know, if we didn't have a reason to be angry before that, we certainly had a reason afterwards.
Well, let's talk about one of the songs you wrote that is instantly recognizable, and let's play it and then talk about it. So talk about writing that. What were you saying with Our Lips Are Sealed?
Well, we had just come back from touring England, and we had opened for the Specials and Madness, who are ska bands. And I had started a romance with the singer of the Specials, this guy, Terry Hall. And so once I got back to California, he was writing me letters and he was talking about how he wanted to have his own band. And he was sending me lyrics or poetry or whatever. And one of them was the beginning of Our Lips Are Sealed, which I really loved. And I was living at home at my parents' house. And I remember sitting up in my bedroom upstairs and working on this song and just falling in love with the song. And like, the more I wrote, the more I felt like, oh my God, what if the Go-Go's don't love this? I'm going to die. And then I brought it to them and they loved it. So that was good.
So that's kind of like what Charlotte went through.
I know. And I actually didn't know that she went through that until I saw the movie.
Really?
Yeah.
So Allison, was that the case that you did these separate interviews for the movie and the members of the band learned a lot about each other through your movie, even though they had spent so much time together?
Yeah, I mean, I think they learned some things. I mean, one of the most profound moments for me doing the interview was with Jane. Jane, when you told me about being diagnosed as bipolar, and you said to me you didn't want me to tell the band that you told me that. You wanted them to learn it in the film. So I didn't say anything to them, and they did, in fact, learn about it while watching the film.
Yeah, that must have been trippy for them. And I mean, it's weird because none of them actually came up to me and were like, oh, I didn't know that. So I don't know if somehow they already knew and they just weren't talking to me about it, but no one's ever talked to me about it. Although, I mean, Charlotte and I are very, very, very close, and she knew about it, and the whole story about me being in the hospital for ages and all that crap. But I don't know. It's just like one of those things, like, how do you bring that up with somebody? It's very awkward.
I guess you do it in a film.
Yeah, right?
But were you diagnosed after you left the band, Jane?
This was pretty recently. This was 2017.
Oh, wow.
Well, Charlotte talked about how proud of you she was for coming out and talking about that, because mental health issues have had such a stigma attached to it. And she felt that with her addiction, and which is why she's been so open about that all these years, too, is to try to help people. Like, look, you know, you're not alone out there.
Yeah. And I have to like give props to Allison that with all five of us, she got stuff out of us that none of us have said in the past.
So in the movie, Charlotte admits that she kept a heroin addiction quite secret from all of you. I mean, it's kind of extraordinary. You spent years touring together and being in the same hotels and partying together and spending almost every waking moment together. And yet no one knew that Charlotte had a very, very serious heroin addiction. Allison, how is she able to just keep that away from the rest of the band?
You know, I don't know. I mean, Jane, you were roommates with her. You didn't see her ever do it. I don't know.
Never.
How she does it. I mean, I've had friends who have been addicts, and it always astounds me how they manage to function.
I know. And that's the right word, too, like functioning drug addict. When you still manage to do everything that you need to do to keep your life going and still keep this part of it secret. But, you know, we were very suspicious, and in fact, it's terrible, but we used to call her the alien because she was so alienated from everybody. And, you know, after shows, everyone would want to go pee backstage, and she'd be in the bathroom for 20 minutes, and we'd be like, well, she's probably doing drugs. But like, what are you going to do when someone just consistently over and over says, no, I'm not, no, I'm not, no, I'm not.
There's also a lot of cocaine going on the side. So that tends to not make things very clear what's happening in front of you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, our band was doing too much of it and using it to sort of cope.
Yeah. And so I guess looking back at it, do you wish that success hadn't happened in the way that it did?
I'm not really a person that has regrets. Like literally the only regrets I have is when I was like unkind. Other than that, I just think like this is all just a journey. And to a certain extent, you don't really have total control over where your journey goes. And I just feel lucky that my life's been so damn interesting. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I look at a lot of people's lives and I'm like, wow, my life's pretty different than most people. And that's the way I like it. So like, it was really fun being a rock star for 10 seconds.
Jane Wiedlin, she's guitarist and backup vocalist for The Go-Go's. Allison Elwood, director of the new Showtime documentary. It's called The Go-Go's. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Been running so long, I nearly lost our touch.
That'll do it for us here at Press Play. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast, listen wherever, whenever you want, KCRW.com/PressPlay. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.